Today's program is brought to you by Oya, a contemporary Japanese restaurant. For more information, visit oyarestaurantboston.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host Akiko Katayama, a food writer and a director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I will try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is John McCarthy, who is a former lawyer who trained himself at the legendary restaurant WD50 to become a chef, and now the chef owner of the new American restaurant, the Crimson Sparrow, in Hudson Valley. And you can find strong Japanese influence on his menu at Crimson Sparrow. So we'll discover how he developed his interest in Japanese flavors and how his life has changed from a veteran lawyer to a successful chef. So hello, John. Welcome to the show.
Akiko-san, it's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. So first, how did you get into cooking?
Well, I took a wrong turn at some point and became a lawyer for a while. I was really interested in cooking as a small child, a teenager. I lived overseas for a while and, really took to some of the flavors and the way that things were prepared. And when I came back to the United States, worked in several restaurants, doing what teenagers do, late teenagers do.
Okay.
And wanted to pursue cooking, but it just wasn't in the cards at the time.
Okay. So sounds like it's a very quick version of what happened. So that's good. But you had, at the age of 14, you moved to Korea for your father's business?
Correct.
Right. And spent almost 3-4 years there?
Correct.
Right. And how was your life in Korea? You're from Maryland, and it must be a little different.
Bel Air, Maryland, and Harford County to Seoul, Korea. it took a little longer to get there then, but we lived there for three and a half years. It was an amazing experience, I think, for anyone who's ever traveled and been fortunate enough to travel, then fortunate enough to live overseas. Living within a different culture is really, the immersion is amazing. And it really, at that time, 14, 15 years old, it makes such an impression, a lasting impression.
Did you have any culture shock?
I'm not sure at that time I knew what it was, but no, I don't. I didn't. Right. I picked up eating Korean food and drinking soju fairly quickly.
Okay, I don't tell your parents.
No, they knew.
Okay. And but how was the food? Because, it's completely different, spicy.
It is. Korean food is much more spicy. There's a lot more heat in the cuisine. Much more meat than I think people realize. An incredible quality of meat, but it's very barbecue-centric, which is really a great, fun experience.
Mm. Okay. And did you get to taste many other Asian flavors in Korea?
Yeah, while we were there, we were able to travel... fortunate enough to travel throughout Asia, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Japan.
Thank you.
Thank you. Philippines. It was an incredible experience. At the time, maybe when you're 14 or 15, you don't appreciate 16, you don't appreciate what you've got. Looking back now, it's probably one of the greatest experiences of my life.
Mm. Okay. And so what was your first Japanese food experience?
I think we talked about this. I think growing up, you know, in the 1970s, it was probably everyone's experience in the 70s of eating at a local, you know, quote unquote Japanese restaurant in the suburbs of Baltimore. You know, you get an appreciation when you live overseas and you're exposed to it directly. Mm. It's a completely different experience. It's hard to go back sometimes.
Right. Okay. And so you came back to the U.S. and became a lawyer and spent 20 years being a lawyer, right?
That's, so yeah, a little less than 20 years.
Okay. Yeah. And what kind of practice did you have?
I was a civil litigator. Mm. I had my own practice in Manhattan for close to 9 years. Mm. Before that, I had worked for several law firms in Tennessee and in New York. also clerked for a United States Court of Appeals judge in Delaware with the Third Circuit. I think I'd done very well as a lawyer. I just didn't like being a lawyer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So what was the decision, you know, the kind of decision you made? It's like a new career, and it happened to be cooking, and you always wanted to be a cook.
I always wanted to be a cook. I had my wife, fortunately, Diana, is very supportive, and in fact, I think sometimes to make these choices, you need to be pushed. And we happened to be walking by the French Culinary Institute, which is now the International Culinary Center in Soho, and she said you should go here.
Wow.
And not long after that, I think I was enrolled. And did it at night, trying at the same time to withdraw myself from the legal world.
Wow.
And found myself really meeting some really great, incredible people who actually led me to where I am today, including Dave Arnold and Nils Noren and Wiley Dufresne.
Okay. So, first of all, so what's special about cooking for you?
As compared to lawyering, there's no comparison. Well, I think with anything that you undertake in life, if you are passionate about it and enjoy it, it's not really work. So, you know, getting up in the morning and knowing that I'm going to be cooking in a kitchen in a restaurant with, you know, my partner now, Ryan Tate, and we've got a great staff. I mean, just being there with people who share that energy is such a much more positive life than I would say dealing with other folks' problems as a lawyer.
Right.
So the any stress placed on me is my own, you know, you can deal with that, hopefully.
Okay. Right. And then let's go back to your people we know. So you mentioned Dave Arnold, who happened to have one of the hosts at the Heritage too. And he's the director of Culinary Technology Department at the International Culinary Center. So, and I heard he invited you to, suggested you train stars at the WD50.
That's correct.
Okay. So, because you're so good and then...
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure exactly why. I think Dave and I kind of met and hooked up. It was actually through a professor at the school named Jason Potanovich, who knew Dave Arnold and connected us and put us together. Mm. And once we were together, suggested that I try to stage at WD50, which I did for my entire time at FCI.
Okay.
And then eventually went to work full time for. Chef Wiley.
Mm. Okay, I asked that question because, you know, WD50, which is unfortunately not closed, but it's legendary and known for innovative techniques and including molecular gastronomy. So I thought, Dave thought you'd be the right fit for the restaurant.
Yeah, I assume maybe I've never really asked him why he did it, but I was very interested in that type of cuisine, modern cuisine, the use of hydrocolloids and the development of cuisine techniques, using those in innovative ways to cook food, prepare food, and I really took a keen interest to it. You know, looking back, it was so many years ago, yeah, I think that's how we connected, and then. He suggested and made the introduction.
Yeah, okay. And what did you learn at WD50?
you don't have enough time on your program. it was just an incredible experience. I made some very, very good friends out of it. My friend John Bignelli, who's in Brooklyn here, J.J. Basil. I mean, there's just so many people that came out of that relationship-wise. But in terms of the cuisine, Chef Wiley, really, I think people don't have maybe the full appreciation of how much he was and is a teacher, mm-hmm. Someone who was excited about what he was doing, learning as he went along and then trying to get us to learn what he knew and progress. Mm. It was an incredibly forward-leaning kitchen. Mm. And, I'm looking forward to what he does next. I really am.
Right. Yeah, so he came over and we had a show together and he has a plan to open a new restaurant. So
I understand that.
Yeah. Right, so, okay. So in 2010, you and your wife, Diana, bought a house in Hudson Valley and you opened the Crimson Sparrow. So did you plan to open a restaurant in Hudson Valley from the beginning?
Not really. We bought a house in Claverick, New York, which is in Columbia County. Mm. It's about 7 or 8 miles from Hudson.
Okay.
And during the course of visiting there, we thought, well, wouldn't it be great to own a restaurant there? I was becoming less and less interested in the law and more focused on cooking. Mm. So it seemed to be a natural progression. So we were able to find the Crimson Sparrow in the building in, I think we closed on the building in October 2011, and opened it June 20th, 2012.
Mm. Okay.
So we're in our fourth year.
Mm. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And I heard that Hudson Valley is now called Williamsburg North because now there are many cool shops and restaurants like yours. So what is the community like? Are there many sophisticated diners, curious diners?
In Hudson, Hudson has often been, I think, referred to in Williamsburg North. I assume it's because of the fact that Hudson holds such a creative hold in that area. Mm. There are an incredible number of artists, musicians, writers, talented people. It's really become sort of the art-centric spot within the Hudson Valley from at least my perspective. Obviously, there are other great places in the Hudson Valley, Storm King down at Beacon, DIA, those kinds of things. But Hudson, in its own right, I think, is an incredibly vibrant and creative place.
Mm. Right. There's places like Fish and Game by Zach Pelagio, of formerly Fatty Crab and Fatty Q, and the other places I heard are Prairie, Whale, and 60 Rosary and Cafe. Those, like, are they all new?
Those are a bit farther south of me.
Oh, okay.
I believe the Prairie Whale is in, well, actually, Prairie Whale, I think, is in the Berkshires. And then Fish and Game is only a couple of blocks. In fact, I saw Zach the other night. Mm. And but yeah, it's they're in, every day we hear about new people coming to Hudson.
Mm.
It's a small town. It's 7,000 people.
Right.
But the number of people that are gravitating towards it, Rivertown Lodge has just opened up across the street from us. There's folks who are out of the city as well, and they've opened a beautiful 27-room boutique motel. So we're hearing about new restaurants, hearing about new projects. So it's not a situation where it remains the same. It's constantly changing.
Mm, right. So, but relatively speaking, it's like a new community.
Absolutely.
Mm.
Absolutely.
Okay. So it's probably you hit the right time.
And it's the only city or town that I can think of on the Hudson line of Amtrak where the stop is dead center in the town.
Mm.
So you don't need a car. You can two hours from Penn Station to Hudson, and I'm a 7-block walk from there.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, and I wanted to mention your interesting lifestyle. So you have a restaurant, and you come down to the city once a week.
I do.
Right. So how does that work out?
You try to pack a lot of drinking and eating into a 36-hour period when you're in the city, and then you go back upstate and work.
Mm.
So, but yeah, it works out really well. It's the best of both worlds, obviously.
Mm.
I get out of the city. I get to do what I love. I come back. could do some amazing things in the city, eat at great restaurants, catch up with folks, and it's fantastic.
Okay. Well, I'm curious, you know, Japanese food-wise, the community in Hudson, there may be less Japanese restaurants in Zero.
There's one sushi restaurant, I think, but in terms of Japanese restaurants, I'm hard-pressed right now to think of one within 25, 30 miles, maybe 50 miles.
Mm. Okay, so...
So I come back to the city. For example, tonight I'm going to eat at Matsui Tempura.
Oh, tempura place. Yeah. Right, so, that's a serious...
It's serious.
Tempura place.
It looks serious.
Mm-hmm.
The check's going to be serious. Between the tempura and the sake and the shochu, yeah, it's going to be a serious bill.
Mm. Well, that's... the price of the history, maybe, of Ginza. Right. Well, but, you know, we're going to talk about your restaurants more and in details, but who are your customers?
I would say 70% of our customers are folks from New York City, or Albany, Western Massachusetts, Berkshires. The remaining 30% are folks that are either local, just moved there, relocated, or people who are really driving up from other communities within the Hudson Valley, say Rhinebeck or Beacon, who are interested in what else is going on in the Hudson Valley. It's, you know, you can cover the Hudson Valley when you get out of the city in basically an hour and a half. You know, we're sort of the northern tip and spear of what I know to be the Hudson Valley. But obviously, if you go beyond and further afield of us, you know, there's Saratoga and places another hour and a half north of us that are really beautiful and actually have some really amazing restaurants as well.
Mm. But I'm kind of surprised because, you know, everybody's talking about Japanese food ramen in the city, but then just step away like 2 hours, only 2 hours, then there's a community, a lot to discover about Japanese cuisine.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay.
And we're trying to bring as much of it as we can to Hudson.
All right. So now let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about how John applies Japanese flavors to his Western style dishes. So please stay with us.
This program is brought to you by Oya, a contemporary Japanese restaurant. Chef Tim and Nancy Cushman opened Oya, a contemporary Japanese restaurant, in March 2007. Since opening, the restaurant has received numerous accolades, including Tim being named Best Chef Northeast by the James Beard Foundation in 2012. Oya was named by the New York Times food critic Frank Bruni as the number one new restaurant in the United States in 2008. Oya is a contemporary Japanese restaurant located in an almost 100-year-old fire station in the historic Leather District of Boston. The menu is izakaya style, which consists of a variety of small plates and is designed to encourage exploring a variety of flavors throughout the meal. The extensive menu includes creative nigiri-style sushi and sashimi, as well as a variety of cooked dishes like luxurious wagyu beef, kurubuta pork, and poulet rouge chicken. A chef's tasting menu, or omakase, is offered and consists of 17-plus courses. A grand tasting menu is also offered, consisting of 20-plus courses, most of which are designed exclusively for that menu. An extensive list of premium sakes, shochus, and Japanese whiskeys are served. For more information, visit oyarestaurantboston.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from our studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is a former lawyer and the chef owner of New American restaurant, The Crimson Sparrow, in Hudson Valley. So you opened the Crimson Sparrow in June 2012. Why did you name it The Crimson Sparrow?
I'm asked that question at least once a week. And For a while there, we would try to give a different answer every time to lend an air of mystery to it, like like the number 33 on the back of a Rolling Rock bottle. But no, it was more of just a couple of guys sitting on a porch drinking whiskey, looking at birds, thinking of names and colors and birds and names and colors. And yeah, you get to the point where, okay, the Crimson Sparrow sounds pretty cool.
Okay.
there's no real deep meaning behind it. Really, there isn't.
Interesting, because sparrows are really very common bird in Japan. I mean, I think more than here even.
Suzume.
Yeah, Suzume. So, yeah, I thought it was something really romantic, Crimson Sparrow.
No.
we'll come up with something.
By the next program, I will have an interesting story for
you. Okay. Yeah, 120 words description. Wait. Okay. And your menu is New American and cooked with Asian flavors using French techniques. So could you give us some examples of your dishes that represent how you apply Japanese flavors to French-style dishes?
Sure. What we try to do at the restaurant is there's two, I guess, categories of Japanese tasting. One would be omakase, associated with sushi, and the other would be kaiseki, which incorporates meat, rice, fish, grilled items, seasonal items. So what we try to do is offer sort of an Americanized or modern take on a kaiseki meal. So what we're trying to do is give the diner the full experience of providing a local product, local vegetables. We're surrounded by farms.
You have only tasting menu?
We have two levels of tasting menu, but then we also do a bar menu that includes, at any given time, 8 to 12 items that can be either shared or, you know, if the diner wishes, they could put together their own sort of tasting menu at the bar if they wish. But all of the bar menus are priced between, I think, $8 and $14. Then the tasting menus are at two different levels.
Right.
8 courses, 10 courses, and then the higher end is 13 or 14 courses. So it's a full 2-hour plus experience. And what we're trying to do is use Japanese ingredients and apply them to dishes that incorporate a lot of local products. One of our favorite, I think, is the bedrock of Japanese washoku, and is dashi. I love making dashi. I don't know why. I just really like making dashi. But the introduction of dashi into various formats and uses, whether it be stocks, the basis for soups or sauces or what have you, I think is it lends itself to the application of French techniques and Japanese ingredients. The marriage of the two is very, very fun.
Okay. And
so, for example, we just had one of the one dishes I really enjoyed in the last menu was green-lipped abalone that was simmered in dashi on a bed of kanji with black truffles and then a dashi pour over with dried chrysanthemum. The whole melding of those flavors, it's almost transportive in a way.
Right. So let me ask. So your dashi is based kombu and bonito.
My dashi recipe is 99% taken from Yoshihiro Murata, the godfather of Kyoto cuisine, and chef owner of Kikunoi.
Kikunoi in Kyoto. Kikunoi, and Michelin 3 stars.
3 stars all over the world.
Right.
So it's kombu, bonito, and water.
Right. By the way, listeners, Murata-san has a beautiful English Japanese book, although Japanese cuisine book.
Yeah, it's called Kaiseki.
Right.
It's an amazing book.
It's beautiful. Right.
I haven't eaten there yet. I tried to call before I went last time, but it was only 3 months in advance, so I couldn't get a reservation.
Well, it's time to plan for this year.
Yeah, I think so.
Like resolution. Right. So so it's bonito and kombu based.
Correct.
Right. So for you, I mean, compared to French stock, what's special about, fish-based dashi, right? So is it widely, applicable to any kinds of food?
I believe dashi is. It introduces a A smokiness and
Smokiness of bonito because it's dried bonito and smoked.
Absolutely. Right. So I think, you know, depending on what flavor profiles you're trying to achieve, the use of the dashi as a base allows you to, you know, elevate that particular sauce or that particular broth, what have you, to another place. And if you make the dashi right, you know, according to Chef Murata-san, I think it's a very easily applicable tool. But, you know, we use other ingredients as well. You know, we try to get authentic Japanese ingredients when available. It's a little bit more difficult in Hudson.
Such as?
Well, it comes to New York, and then it's got to get somehow from New York City to Hudson. So,
What kind of ingredients is hard to get?
Well, I would say that it's made so much easier by companies like New York Mutual Trading Company. I have a friend there, Aya Kuroda, who really is, she's also trained as a chef, so she's a valuable resource in trying to source, you know, anything we're looking for, whether it be, you know, abalone, whether it be the best bonito, the best kombu. You know, she also, the New York Mutual also, provides us some of our sakes and shochu. So,
New York Mutual Trading Companies, that's one of the biggest Japanese grocery items.
Yeah.
Right? Sake or food.
Amazing.
Items.
I think it was, they've been around since 1948, I think.
Very long time. Right. Okay. Right. And so, you know, going back to dashi, to me, some American people find it fishy because it's oceanic. You know, flavors. Do you have any problem applying it to meat dishes?
I do not. I do not. In fact, I think the marriage of those two is delicious. I don't find it fishy, overly fishy. I tend to get more of the smokiness out of it and the richness out of it. You know, I don't know. I've cooked for my mother a couple of times. I don't know that she likes everything I cook, but probably because more often than not it tastes fishy. So
okay,
right. I can understand. I can relate to these people objecting to it.
Right. I'm curious though. What kind of meat dish do you have with dashi?
I think pork. We use dashi with pork belly. As I'm thinking back, fairly regularly. I like those two together. You know, we've used dashi and sauces on dishes that we've had using venison.
You know, that sounds great.
It is delicious. It is really good. I think it lends itself. I mean, I don't, because I don't find it fishy. I think it's the umami laden richness and smokiness of dashi that allows it to be a versatile tool with pretty much anything.
Okay, and I found a couple dishes from a tasting menu on the website, and have little neck clams, squid, sake leads. What kind of dishes? This one is.
Wow, I think that one was actually it was a sake leads broth that we had taken the clams and smoked the clams, and then with the squid, I think we had pickled the squid. Wow. So it was really if anyone's never had sake lees. Sake lees is the, I guess, the matter left over after the pressing of the sake.
Yeah.
And you can use it in sauces. You can also use it to cure fish or pickle or whatever you want to apply with it. It's really delicious.
Yeah, it's like the solid substance after you press the sake. And then I heard it's full of nutrition such as protein, fiber, vitamin Bs, and zinc.
Yep, and it's almost 8% alcohol.
Okay, that sounds even better.
I wouldn't chew it and eat it, though.
And you had a matsutake mushroom dashi shrimp.
Yeah, this one was just really a very straightforward dish of using the matsutake mushroom, which obviously has a very piney, forest floor kind of flavor. We made a very clean, very clean dashi. And then some shrimp were added. So I think in many ways that type of dish sort of emblemizes what we're trying to do, which is to make things a bit simpler, pull back a bit. And, you know, it's also, as you and I talked before, it's very risky. because if one of those elements is not right, the whole dish feels wrong. But if it's done right, each one of those three, you know, marries and sings, and at the end of the day, it's a very transportive experience for the diner.
So very much a balance, right? Because, for instance, like a matsutake, which is I think it's an equivalent of white truffles, very expensive in
Japan.
And it's seasonal only in, I think I would say September, October, and you know, like because it's such a precious item, you know, like caviar or. You know, like anything very expensive, you have only pasta and the shaved truffles. So it's about the balance. So it's the same thing, that when same approach as you have.
When we get the matsutake in, only myself or Ryan are allowed to touch them.
Okay.
We count them every day.
Yeah, it's really expensive.
They are very expensive.
Right.
But like, very much worth it.
Okay. And so I heard you change your menu, not just every season, but a lot more frequently. Is that because you are close to local farms in Hudson Valley, or you have the mindset of Japanese cuisine, which has 12 to even 16 seasons a year?
I think in many respects, both are valid reasons for it. We change our menu, if not one or two elements or dishes, probably every day, every other day. But the whole menu changes over. We try to do it every 2 weeks. In the summer, obviously, it's a much more active period for the farms, and we're constantly getting new things from the farms. I mean, we have three farms located within, you know, 10 miles of the restaurant. You know, Letterbox Farm, Common Hand Farm, Max Morningstar, and Blue Star Farms. They are all amazing farms, amazing people, and their products are great. And so if you're able to use something that was grown a quarter mile from your restaurant, it's so much the better. But it's also, I think, maybe I'm making up for lost time. Constantly changing it, doing different things, so many things in my head that need to get out. If not, I feel maybe not bored, but... maybe frustrated that I didn't have them out earlier. So we'll see.
Right. So new ideas every day.
Every day.
Right. Yeah. This frequent change of menu reminds me of, like, you know, if you go to Kyoto Kaiseki restaurants, they are really close by to, you know, by the farms. Like, you are just like you are in Hudson Valley.
Right.
So it's a mandatory, and you have to.
You have to. If not, it's a waste.
Right. And so you have a special ramen on Wednesday nights at the...
So we started doing ramen on Wednesdays. We were looking for a way to fill the middle of the week. And so we decided to do Suzume ramen, Sparrow ramen on Wednesdays. It started maybe 2 months ago, 3 months ago. And we've sold out pretty much every single one of them. Each week we try to do a different broth, a different... broth, a different noodle, a different application, not only to just try things out, but also to keep it different for the customers. I mean, you have to keep in mind we're in a small town.
Right.
So, you know, we want people to come back every single week. So we're trying to keep it new and inventive and fresh for them, and the experience fresh every week.
Okay. So what kind of dashi do you use for the ramen?
Well, we used dashi, but the broths have ranged from... you know, last week we did a chicken broth, and it's, I mean, the broths take us anywhere from a day and a half to 4 days, depending on the type of broth. You know, we've done tonkatsu broths a couple of times, and that's, I think, we do it almost for 90, the broth is simmered for almost 96 hours.
Okay.
So it takes a while. And people ask, well, why don't you offer three different kinds? Well, I don't have enough stove space or patience for three, but we tend to offer one. And you know, we're working on a recipe for a vegetarian one because it's been asked for, so we're gonna try it.
Right. And the topping wise, do you do a traditional style or?
We do traditional style. We also try to mix it up a bit. I mean, the soy egg is always a big hit. You know, whether it's watercress, enoki mushrooms, you know, the requisite nori and naruto maki, the fish cake that goes on. But we've also done ramen where we've introduced. You know, kimchi. We've done this beautiful pork broth and then pureed kimchi into it and added as a tare some gochujang base. So I think we changed that a bit because it was cold that weekend. We said, "Oh well, we don't want something spicy this weekend," so we changed it. And you know, pork belly is usually shows up. Mm-hmm. The pork chashu. It all depends on what we're feeling like doing. So.
Okay, so ramen is also available at your restaurant in Hudson.
Only on Wednesday from 5:30 to about 7:30, 8 o'clock, because by then we're usually sold out.
Oh, wow.
It doesn't last long.
Okay, and so, you know, we talked about your experience at WD50, so I'm curious how you apply scientific elements to your dishes. Do you have a lot of them, or you have subdued application?
No, I think it's a subdued application. I think thanks to Chef Wiley and others that those techniques have been so widely accepted that they're really commonplace in kitchens. You know, I'm sure most kitchens have the same hydrocolloids I have. I'm sure they use them in the same way. I think, you know, the genius of Chef Wiley was to be able to coax out of those things that people wouldn't even think of in their wildest dreams. You know, why would I do that? But you know, that kind of reaction. But I think in many respects it's our cuisine is much more subdued.
Right. So it's not visible.
Well, it may be visible if you know what you're looking for.
Okay. Like,
but we don't, you know, the servers don't go to the table and say, "Oh, this contains xanthan gum, methyl cellulose, and high and low acylgelin." I don't think diners want to hear that. But I think it's there. I think the applications, you know, are very creative, but we maybe in the total picture they don't pick out that element. They're more enamored, hopefully, with how it tastes, the flavor, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, the xanthan gum, for instance, it's a very efficient way and no flavor. It doesn't hurt anything of the ingredients. So
go to the supermarket and look at your condiment aisle. It's in every single one of them.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I asked this question because, you know, like natural or traditional versus scientific. And then people may have some problems with that. But like,
maybe, but I've had a couple of Japanese chefs reach out to me and ask me to just talk about it with them and, you know, give them some, you know, very rudimentary instruction, because I think they're very interested in it.
Well, are they Japanese chefs in Japan?
Japanese chefs in New York.
Okay, interesting. Right. And actually, I know a group of top kaiseki chefs, actually including Murata-san of Kikunoi. They work closely with Kyoto University about food science to analyze, like, you know, how can you make kombu more flavorful? You take out of extract out of the same kombu based on the water, you know, the mineral level, that kind of thing, for instance. So I think science is becoming naturally into traditional cuisine too.
Well, I think understanding the science, and this is probably a quote from Wiley Dufresne, but understanding the science behind cooking will make your cooking better. You know, understanding the reason why you're doing something or the purpose for it drives the next step or of what you're going to do.
Right.
Without understanding that, I think you're sort of flailing away blindly in the night. But if you understand what the science is behind the application of time and heat and temperature to something, you're going to be a much better cook.
Right. Yeah. For instance, I know Chef, you know, Seiji Yamamoto at the Ryugen in Tokyo. And he CT scanned hamal, like a eel-like fish, because if you get hamal, because it's so bony, and you just need experience to make it not too bony. And then he CT scanned it, and then now he knows the structure of the bones, so you don't have to be completely spending 30 years to be able to cut perfect hamal.
Amazing.
Right, so anyways. Now, on your beverage menu, you have 7 sakes and 3 shochu, and versus 19 kinds of wine, which I found. So that's a big proportion on the menu. So what does appeal to you about sake compared to wine, beer?
We have almost as many sakes as we have wine. Mm-hmm. We just don't put all of them on the list.
Oh, wow.
We kind of rotate them through. Mm. We have a beverage pairing that we've been doing for several years now that offers wine, sake, and sometimes shochu. Mm. And sort of introduces a diner through the beverage pairing to sake. And, you know, the most common thing we hear is, oh my gosh, I didn't know sake could be consumed cold. You know, so we're in the, when we opened, it was very hard to sell sake and shochu.
Wow.
It's becoming much easier now. And I think folks are, particularly if you look at our ramen nights, we feature a couple of sakes that we think would pair well with the ramen. And we usually sell out of the sake because people are being directed to it and trusting us to offer a sake that will complement whatever they're eating. So it's been very well received. Mm-hmm. I've had some amazing people help me. Yasuyuki Suzuki is the manager for Bar Sekki, and Sake Sommelier is amazing. Mm-hmm. I was trained by Tim Sullivan of Urban Sake.
Right.
And Stephen Lyman is probably, I mean, like, I don't know where he learns all of this stuff about shochu, but it's an amazing experience to be around them all to hear. You know, and you look at what's been done by others as well, particularly Chris Johnson and John Gauntner. I mean, it's amazing when you consider that there's probably, one book on shochu by Chris Pellegrini. And, you know, there's very few sake, English sake guides or manuals.
Right.
So it's, you have to look to these people, otherwise there's no other way to learn.
Right. And I heard you have a sake advisor and sommelier certification to take that mission. And how did you take it? Was it hard to take?
Oh, it was fun. We drank sake for 2 days.
Okay.
It's one of the easier educational experiences you'll have. You know, Tim Sullivan was the teacher of that class along with a gentleman. I think his name was Toshio Ueno. And you know, it's over the course of a couple of days. It's actually two separate classes that I think you have to pass one to get to the second level, and then it involves basically understanding the brewing process, the types of sake, and then you have to basically test it and identify it and offer notes, tasting notes. So it's a it's very expedited as compared to, say, a wine somm. But, you know, it's a tremendous experience if you're interested in taking learning about sake. They also offer one for shochu.
Okay. So I heard that this is an organization called SSI, and which is based in Japan, and to promote the sake and shochu. And I think the certification was made to create the professionals who can propose, offer, and sell good sake and shochu. So it sounds like you're the right person.
Oh, yeah, and I love drinking it.
So do you think our listeners who are interested can take the exam and get certified?
Sure. I think the program, again, I think is run through, if you go to urbansake.com, Tim Sullivan offers the program. Also, I believe John Gauntner.
Okay, guest.
Offers as a school as well.
Okay.
Or a class as well.
Tim Sullivan, by the way, he's like you, and he's a good technology person, and then converted to completely a sake expert.
Absolutely.
An amazing talent.
Brand ambassador, I think, for Hakkai-san.
Yes.
But I also have some very good friends, Andrew Richardson out of World of Sake. They import some of the most beautiful sakes we have.
Nice.
And, you know, so if you surround yourself with those folks and you're able to make the connection, there's a lot of outlets for education. You know, and I recommend anytime you are paying for education associated with the consumption of sake or shochu, it's money well spent.
Okay. All right, so it's urbansake.com.
For Tim, yes. And then John Gauntner, I think they can find through your program.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Okay, so Japanese, look at John Gauntner.
If you want an introduction, I think a great one also is Bar Sekki, the new Sekki restaurant up on 48th Street. Yasu-san and
Yasu Suzuki.
Yasu and Rick Zuad. Mm-hmm. They put together basically a sake club on Mondays.
Okay.
And it's an incredible, if you want great education, Yasu-san is an amazing teacher.
Okay.
Passionate and really delicious sakes.
Mm.
I recommend it.
Okay, sounds good. So it's on 23rd
Street?
It's 48th. 48th Street.
48th and 9th.
Okay.
Between 8th and 9th, I believe. Right.
So it's in Sushiseki. There's a bar, Seki?
It's the brand new, I think they call it Bar Seki.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds great. All right. And so I heard you starred or cooked with the sushi master in Tokyo recently.
Two years ago.
2 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. So what was the experience?
It convinced me that I'm too old to be a sushi chef, or at least train with a sushi chef. 2 years ago, I was fortunate enough to work for a month with the master of my friend Shimazu Masato.
Formerly at the 15 East.
Yeah. And he arranged for me to stage there. Mm. Basically, you're up at 4:30 in the morning. You're at Tsukiji Market, then you're back cleaning fish, and you're doing lunch service.
Mm.
And then you get an hour and a half to sleep, and then you go back and you do it all over again for dinner. And at midnight, you're mopping out the kitchen, and you go to sleep, and you're up at 4:30. It's a grueling, grueling life. But I think it gives you an appreciation of what actually goes into the training of a sushi master.
Mm.
I mean, only a month, but... Man, it was the hardest work I'd done.
Okay, right. So Masato Shimizu was really known for being a great sushi chef, and he is now in Thailand. But I interviewed him earlier, like a couple years ago, and he said he was under the master, I think, Rikkyo Kugo.
Rikkyo Sugo?
Yeah,
Kugo. Kugo.
And
they called him Dana-san.
Okay. Yeah, so he was a real craftsman, and he said, you know, work as the management and just respect everything, clean everything perfectly, and learn from everything, even clothing of your clients. And that's the attitude of improvement.
That about sums it up better than I could have. I mean, it's a pursuit of perfection, cleanliness, hospitality that is unparalleled. The restaurant, by the way, was Sukaroku.
Right,
in Tokyo. Kameido.
Right, it's a downtown Tokyo, so it's Sukaroku. Okay. Right, okay. So I heard that you're working on a new restaurant concept.
Yeah, in a couple of weeks, we're going to open A&B Food Co. At 920 Alton Road in Miami Beach.
Mm.
It is with a gentleman, we're partnering with a gentleman named Tatanka Guerrero, very energetic, passionate guy, was in the nightlife scene in Miami and New York and Tokyo, and we're going to put together a restaurant and a bar experience that's going to take a lot of the elements from the Crimson Sparrow and translate it into a South Florida restaurant.
Mm, including some Japanese elements?
Absolutely. Mm. It, again, will be a revisited or revised or reformulated kaiseki experience.
Mm.
And we'll have a significant number of sakes and shochus available through a lot of the folks we're able to use here.
Wow.
It's interesting because a lot of the vendors don't offer a lot of the sakes we have in New York here in Florida.
Mm.
So right there you can know that the appreciation and education level in New York for sake and shochu is far outpaced Florida, but we're going to do what we can.
Mm.
It'll be a lot of fun.
Right.
So and we have some other projects too where Ryan and I are working on, so it's going to be a very exciting 2016.
Oh, wow. Great. You're going to be even busier.
Busier, less time for drinking, Kiko-san.
You can always find time to drink.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So thank you for joining us today, John.
Arigato gozaimasu.
So please keep us posted.
Absolutely.
Right. So let us know when you open the restaurant in Miami.
Will do. I think it's going to be in mid-February.
Okay. Great. All right. So listeners, if you'd like to know more about John's restaurant, please visit thecrimsonsparrow.com.
And if you have any questions or comments about the show, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. And by the way, we just launched a beautiful new website, so please visit our page. Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher Podcasts. Today's show was made possible by Oya Restaurants, and our engineer is Liz Smith. Please stay warm, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.